Says my name as a juice.
Well, thanks very much, everybody. I'm Dick Adams, joint chair of the Parliamentary Library, and I'm here to introduce Scott Brenton, and just to say, you know, the Parliamentary Library, I guess on behalf of the Parliament, manages the Australian Parliamentary Fellowship and has done so since programmed since 1970. So it's really long and a really solid piece of an institution for the Parliament. Scott Brenton, the 2009 Fellow, is studying contemporary bicameralism in Australia, focusing on the difference between senators and members of the House of Representatives. And I was just saying to him, a bit of work that there hasn't been much work probably done on that, in that area. So well overdue and well overdue. Now, I know that life is very fragile, and I accept that. And when I looked, you know, at the sadness of yesterday and seeing that Airbus, somebody that flies in aeroplanes all the time, you realise how fragile it is. But then I see that Scott did his PhD at ANU on political scandals. I've also felt that, you know, you're only probably 1 foot away from that in political life as well, depending on who writes the stories, etc., and how many of your enemies politically are in the ascendancy. So Scott has developed surveys and information and is talking to senators and members of the House of Representatives, and I understand that his work is going very well, and he's going to speak to us about that now. So welcome, Scott, and great, good luck with it, and look forward to your final work.
Thank you to the Chair and to the Library Committee for this opportunity. Someone who's studied Parliament from the outside for many years, being based in Parliament House, offers quite a unique and different perspective, and I'm hoping to share some of that perspective with you today. Let's begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, the Ngunnawal people. I look forward to the day that Indigenous people are once again represented in our national parliament. And I don't mean that to be a controversial political statement, because it shouldn't be, but rather as a segue into today's topic on representation and what that actually means in practice in Australia. So clearly this is a big topic, and certainly bigger than I can give justice to today. So you'll have to read the monograph next year. All I'm intending to do is a work in progress, really introducing the topic, opening up some questions to think about, but I'm also hoping to get some suggestions for further lines of inquiry, still quite early stages. So having said that, I don't intend to speak for the full hour, probably just about half that time, and leaving plenty of time for questions, comments, suggestions at the end. But given it's a small group, I'm also happy to stop at any point if people have questions on a particular slide I'm talking about. I can see in the audience there are many experts in the politics field here today, but given that these seminars can draw a mixed range of people, I might just do a quick Politics 101 overview of what is quite a unique system, just for anyone who might be unfamiliar with it. I guess the logical starting point for any discussion of Australian bicameralism is the Constitutional Conventions of the 1890s, where the Founding Fathers, as you can see in that photograph, they were all men, assembled in Adelaide, Sydney, Melbourne to draft a written constitution. And this is the first point of departure from the British Westminster model, which is largely based on unwritten conventions. But as British colonies, it was just natural to look towards the motherland and the Westminster parliamentary system, where the executive sits in and is responsible to the legislature, or effectively to the People's House or the lower house of Parliament. But what I really like about PowerPoint is you can do dramatic sort of Mythbuster-style projections of popular beliefs. Not that this is particularly controversial amongst political scientists in Australia, is we're clearly not a Westminster system, perhaps a Washminster mutation, but definitely not Westminster. As even back then, these almost Australians were looking towards the United States for inspiration rather than Britain, and in particular the Federalist Papers written by the United States' own founding fathers. So from the names of our houses to the very idea of a written constitution and the structure of our constitution, the American experience was more influential and was, as was a carefully considered decision, to federate with a powerful upper house. Constitutional framers openly acknowledged the fundamental incompatibility between a cabinet system of government, of responsible government, and proposals for a co-equal upper house. One of those delegates, South Australian Premier Thomas Playford, was particularly sceptical, and I'd just like to share with you some of his comments. I'll ask the Honourable Member, does he know where responsible government has ever adapted itself to the circumstances of two co-equal houses? Nowhere in the world. At one time, in fact, that House of Lords had greater power than the Commons, but we never obtained responsible government in the mother country until the power of the House of Lords was taken away and lodged in the House of Commons. I believe you cannot carry on responsible government satisfactorily with two absolutely co-equal houses. And while not absolutely co-equal, and apart from an Labor partisans in the room, but let's just call it a blip in 1975, Australia's unique system of government has carried on satisfactorily and has been remarkably stable. What was even more innovative at the time is that, unlike the British House of Lords or the American Senate as it was comprised then, is that Australia's upper house was directly elected by the people from the very beginning. So this leads to the second mythbuster. Australia's upper house was never a state's house. Certainly it was designed to give equal representation in terms of the numbers of seats from each state, but that is not the same as representing the states. Indeed, the constitutional conventions explicitly rejected proposals to call the upper house the States Assembly or the Council of the States. Rather, it was the American terms for the houses that were adopted, but not the common American practice of the time, whereby state legislatures chose their Senate representatives rather than the people directly. Australians, by and large, have always directly elected their senators on national party lines rather than state lines, and the major parliamentary parties have always sat as national parties and voted on party lines rather than state lines. Indeed, there's only ever been one standalone state party that has achieved representation in the Australian Parliament, and that was the Western Australia Party, which won two seats at the 1906 election in the House of Representatives. Yet this mythology endures, perhaps because it is a neat explanation of Australian bicameralism, and it isn't completely historically inaccurate, it just doesn't tell the whole story. But my fellowship project isn't about our democratic institutions per se, as there is extensive existing research comparing the powers, functions, compositions of the different houses. What I'm interested in is the political actors, that is, the parliamentarians, and how they engage in democratic representation. Again, popular beliefs are a useful starting point in how we see our representatives. But given that only about 16% of Australians report having had some form of contact with a federal member of parliament, it's safe to assume that most citizens only see their representatives either on the nightly news or in the costly electorate newsletters. The evening news typically provides snippets from question time in the House of Representatives, and which, not including this current sitting, has taken up to 28 hours and 34 minutes so far this year. So assuming a very conservative and non-Prime Minister run 9-to-5, 5-day working week, calculated that that's about 3% of a member's time being spent asking, answering, listening to questions in the chamber. Electorate newsletters showcase a much wider range of activities that members undertake. But having lived in several different electorates in different states and also in the ACT, I've only ever received such regular newsletters from members of the House of Representatives, never senators. And when I taught in the Australian politics course at the ANU, a straw poll of students revealed exactly the same thing. So with the focus on the House of the Representatives, once again, it's safe to assume that most people don't know much about the work of senators. Very limited media attention is given to the Senate, except when there is contentious legislation, and crossbench votes are needed by the government. Now, this is a bit harder to quantify, but assuming that this only happens during sitting days, so far this year, senators have spent about 14% of their time wheeling into one year in Canberra. Occasionally, as right now, through Senate committees and estimates in particular, the spotlight shines onto the work of the Senate. And yes, if you haven't already guessed, I am more of a quantitative researcher. And last year, the Senate spent 1,955 hours and 14 minutes in Senate and joint committees. Now, since senators are often involved in more than one committee, it's an imperfect measure, but as a proportion of the collective working time of senators, this accounts for less than 2% of their collective working time, which was quite surprising. But even at a surface level, this is not particularly accurate or a fair account of the work of senators and members. But with semi-regular media hype and almost universally negative public perceptions about politicians, these stereotypes tend to reinforce each other. So at a very basic level, my study is attempting to challenge some of the negative perceptions by quantifying the different types of work that senators and members do, while also exploring the diverse range of roles and responsibilities that they have, particularly away from the public and media eyes. And this is what informs the first stage of my research, which, as Mr. Adams mentioned, consists of a survey of current and former senators and members. The data is still being collected and compiled at the moment, but with the response rate of current parliamentarians, understandably given their workloads, running at about 25%, I could encourage anyone in the audience who has contact with senators and members to just gently remind them of this study and the value of their participation. So one of the aims of the survey is to measure the size of their workloads and size of workloads of modern politicians with the demands that we and expectations we have of them. And I think this will be of interest to the wider community, and also to the media during the inevitable slow news day sort of debates slash wish chants on politicians' paying entitlements. So there are many questions in the survey asking about the work patterns of parliamentarians and particularly the differences in sitting and non-sitting weeks. Just the amount of travel involved in being a representative. This is rarely discussed unless it can be sensationalised under the headline travel routes. But when you think about it, for rural and regional members, or even members from Perth, just to travel to attend sittings is quite a significant burden on their time. All the demands of the 24-hour news cycle, from sunrise to late night, the precious fundraise, not to mention the commonly expected tasks of legislating and attending community events and public functions. So this leads to a central aim of the study. Are the various activities and the balance between them significantly different for senators compared to members? The example of being active in the local community is arguably, but from the perspective of an outsider, more important for a member with an electorate than a senator looking after the whole state. And I'm sure members would feel this way, but I'm wondering, do senators feel that way? I'll come back to this a little later because I think this lies at the heart of representation. The survey also asks why parliamentarians chose the chamber they did, whether they ever contested pre-selection or election for a seat in the other chamber, and if they had not been elected, would they have considered contesting the other chamber? As political science, this is particularly interesting because thinking back to our constitutional design and how much was actually inspired by the United States system, while its federal system, state-based representative chamber, proved an irresistible model, the stature of the United States Senate was not successfully transplanted here. Rather, the Australian Senate retains a sense of illegitimacy, like the British House of Lords, and evidenced by, usually when the government doesn't get what it wants, occasional calls for its abolition or for significant reforms. One of the main differences between the Australian and American Senates is that the American Senate has more special powers compared to the House of Representatives. And US senators have a higher status than representatives, and it is often considered the more successful stepping stone to the presidency. Again, as an outsider and someone with very limited political ambitions, I actually quite like the idea of a fixed six-year term representing a larger constituency, and yes, even the title senator seems more appealing to me. But in Australia, it's the reverse. High status seems to attach to members of the House of Representatives, and such that senators with serious, in inverted commas, political ambitions should consider changing houses. And that's happened many times in the past, and of course, most recently, Senator Joyce openly canvassed the possibility. none of this is particularly surprising given that the highest elected offices, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, traditionally have sat on the House of Representatives. But they certainly don't have to. After all, they're not even mentioned in our constitution, and we even had a senator become Prime Minister before, albeit briefly, as Senator John Gordon switched to the House of Representatives. And you may have read Malcolm McKerris's article in The Australian last week that challenged the myth that a senator can't be Prime Minister. Furthermore, treasurers can serve in upper houses, as they have and do in New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania. But status and ambition aside, do politicians have a preference for a particular house when they first enter politics? Or, and perhaps more cynically, is it just where they can get pre-selected or where a factional deal has been done? I'm not sure, and that's something I'm interested in finding out. The Deputy Prime Minister once contested a Victorian Senate seat in the unwinnable number 3 position on the Labor ticket in 1996, before finally being successfully elected to the House of Representatives. But for some reason now, I just can't imagine a Senator Gillard. And I wonder how many other parliamentarians who have successfully built reputations as acerbic and witty performers in the question time in the House of Reps, or alternatively as inquisitive interrogators in Senate estimates, could have actually been successful in the other chamber. While this can never be known, I do ask how confident parliamentarians would feel about switching houses, and whether they think the job is the same on the other side, or the dark side, as officers in the House departments keep on referring to each other in interviews. Finally, the survey asks parliamentarians how they actually engage in representation. How do they know what their constituents think? And who or what do they actually represent? Now, in talking to officers of both the House departments, the most common initial response to this broad research question about the similarities and differences in representation is that members of the House of Representatives have constituents and constituencies, and Senate officers certainly didn't disagree with that. Now, I'm assuming, and I soon will find out, that members and senators probably concur with this basic proposition, which is the second stage of my research. But again, it is only half the equation. So we know who members represent, but who or what do senators represent? The fallback position is, of course, that senators represent the states, or represent parties, or more particularly that the Senate is no longer a state's house but a party's house, which is a rather curious observation given that most members also represent parties. Indeed, strictly speaking, both members and senators represent constituents living in defined geographic areas. It's just that one of those areas is significantly bigger than the other. So can it be argued that senators are more representative because they usually represent more people? For example, balance of power holder Senator Steve Fielding is often criticised because he was only elected with 1.9% of the first preference vote. And so the argument goes that he has disproportionate influence, leaving aside that this is only a consequence of the strict party discipline in the major parties. But Senator Fielding actually received 55,551 first preference votes when he was elected in 2004, compared to the Prime Minister's 43,957 first preference votes in the electorate of Griffith at the last election. And that's nothing compared to Senator Abib in New South Wales at the last election, with over 1.7 million votes. And yes, most Australians do vote for party tickets in the Senate, but party and party leaders are just as important in lower house contests. And yes, the Senate contests are decided by more voters, but that's precisely my point. Why doesn't more people equate with more representational status as it does in the United States Senate? Rather, the discussions of the Australian Senate representation often focus on why does Tasmania, with 12 senators, have X times the voting power of New South Wales, given that it also has 12 senators with a much larger population. Again, leaving aside the quite significant disparities that exist in lower house electorate enrolments, particularly here in the ACT. But given that most question marks and senses of illegitimacy are levelled against the Senate, I've devoted the third stage of my research to the issue of Senate constituencies. So at a basic geographic level, I've mapped, or rather, Parliamentary Library's mapping expert Klaus Inveen, who's here today, has kindly mapped for me the location of the Senate offices and changes over time. Because I think this gives some clues to how senators themselves conceive of representation of their state or territory. Again, the magic of PowerPoint. One noticeable trend over the last 30 years has been the gradual dispersal outwards from the capital cities, or most more precisely the capital city CBDs, with the major parties allocating duty electorates to senators. And I won't go into that here, but that's something that I explore in my monograph. But senators' offices are still concentrated in the capitals, entirely in the cases of Western and South Australia, even Victoria now. But the notable exception is Tasmania, where senators from both major parties have spread themselves across the state. Perhaps this reflects the more decentralised nature of Tasmania, but I also think it gives Tasmanian senators collectively a much stronger claim that they actually represent at least the geographic diversity of their state, particularly as their mainland counterparts are concentrated so much in the CBDs of their capitals. But geography, despite the importance it's given to in our electoral system, is merely one component of representation. And I think senators representing bigger and more diverse geographic electorates actually transcend those boundaries much more readily and come to represent non-geographically based constituency groups. So this idea came from through a background interview I had with a senior Senate officer, and is perhaps a natural evolution of the Senate committee system, where senators often have particular policy interests through their committee work, and will develop such interests through their committee work. So many senators become important political allies of particular groups in the wider community pursuing similar policy outcomes, be it groups interested in tax reform or refugee advocates or tertiary education unions or rural organisations. These groups often become the constituencies of senators. While these policy interests are often exposed through committee work, it may take several years for a senator to develop a profile in the chosen areas. So in my study, I'm examining the first speeches to Parliament made by senators and seeing who or what they think they will be representing in the Senate. So do they focus on the state, on state or particular state issues, or do they reference broader national issues and international issues? In my preliminary analysis, it appears to be the latter, although state issues and state identity aren't completely ignored. Another reason for looking at first speeches is, I think, and again, this is only as a cynical outsider, is they appear to be more personal and give more authentic insights into the motivations and character of the parliamentarians compared to some of the more scripted, to say strategically determined speeches or questions, be it party questions in question time or electronic transmission of questions to Senate and Estimates Committees. First speeches appear to be written by the individual rather than the party, and while they're naturally party political, I think they do reveal the ideals and aspirations, perhaps still untainted by soundbites and spin, of the parliamentarians and what they think they will achieve. What do they think the job involves? I will then compare this with their valedictory speeches, where available, and also compare the first speech of senators with first speeches of members, and where available, valedictory speeches of members. But of course, they don't always have the opportunity to make those speeches. I suspect the members will make more reference to their local electorates, but one presumably does not go into federal politics just to address local issues. So it will be interesting to see whether there is a qualitative difference between how senators and members see themselves as representing broader issues and how they conceive of their constituencies. Now, I began the seminar by observing the current absence of Indigenous Australians in our national parliaments, and only two have ever served in our parliaments, in the Senate to be precise. This is just one of many minority groups who are currently underrepresented in parliaments. Another significant minority, although they're actually a majority, is women, occupying just 27% of the seats in the House of Representatives and 36% of the seats in the Senate. The youngest ever women to be elected and sit in Parliament were senators. The first Australians of Asian descent to sit in Parliament were senators, and the only openly gay and lesbian parliamentarians senators. So the list goes on and on, but the thing is the same. That minority groups have generally fared better in the Senate. Or as some more radical proponents have suggested, the Senate is the real House of Representatives. Now, there are various possible reasons for this, which I won't go into here, but this is also part of the third stage of my study, as I'm looking into the backgrounds and characteristics of parliamentarians, and whether one House better mirrors Australia's diversity more than the other House. This is the idea of mirror representation. That is the idea that Parliament should reflect the different demographic groups in Australian society. Now, it is a very contentious idea, as more diverse representation does not necessarily or automatically lead to better representation. And it is something that's been critiqued by many others, including previous parliamentary fellows, so it's not something I'm planning to do, but rather acknowledge that it is a dimension of representation and simply assess our parliamentary representation according to that dimension. The final stage of the research, and perhaps again very cynically, of most interest centres and members, is which house is it easier to become a minister? Well, that's the crude version. What I'm more interested in is executive legislative relations from the perspective of the political actors and the differences in being a minister in the Senate compared to being a minister in the House. Again, this issue is being explored competently and fairly thoroughly from an institutional context. So, for example, the argument that if the Senate is to be a genuine House of Review, ministers should not sit there. And I don't think that that's likely to change in the near future. So what I'm more interested in is what does the current situation mean in terms of representation, and what's the difference in being a minister in the different houses? Once again, as an outsider, I think I would prefer to be a minister in the Senate, as to get into that position, I would logically also be a senior member of the party and therefore virtually guaranteed a safe top two position on the Senate ticket for a fixed 6-year term and not have to worry about an electorate. And actually, don't say this cynically, because I think that being a minister is a full-time job in itself, with significant commitments in Canberra and greater than average and constant national and international travel commitments, and yet they still have to be good local members, as they may be in a marginal seat. And the situation of the former Prime Minister is a classic example of the pitfalls of that. But then, as Senate officers pointed out in background interviews, and I think this is often overlooked, all ministers are representative of the other house by a ministerial colleague. And of course, there are less of them in the Senate, which means that they not only have to be across their own portfolios, but also many others. And while the Senate's question time may not have the same prominence as the reps, to put it bluntly, the Senate is where legislation ultimately matters. And the votes of the questioners do actually matter so flippant, and the actual responses will only go so far. Unfortunately, from the perspective of my study, given that ministers are so busy, it's understandably difficult to schedule interviews, so for this stage I'm relying more on other sources of information in addition to the survey, but also interviews with close political observers, principally the senior officers in the chamber departments, but many former ministers, speakers and Senate presidents have also been very cooperative in this area. But just a couple of interesting statistics I'd like to share now. Firstly, the proportion of senators in ministries since Federation. This is depicted by the red line in this graph. Against the blue line, which is the proportion of senators in Parliament. Now, the blue line's fairly constant, at about a third, of course, due to the nexus provision in the Constitution, which stipulates that the number of members shall be about twice the number of senators. However, while senators comprise a third of the number of parliamentarians, they have rarely comprised a third of the ministry, let alone more than a third. So this graph is somewhat misleading, as it's looking at the whole parliament, and while theoretically the executive is drawn from the legislature, more precisely in practice it's from the governing party or parties in the legislature, and the governing party or parties have generally had healthy majorities in the House but not necessarily in the Senate. Therefore, senators often comprise less than a third of the parliamentary membership of the governing party or parties. So in the second graph, it charts the proportion of ministers amongst government members since Federation, and that's with the green line, against the proportion of ministers amongst government senators, which is depicted by the red line. So the short and simple answer to my earlier question is that it does appear to be easier to become a minister in the House, although interestingly you can see in the 90s the proportions of ministers among government senators has been higher than the proportion of government members in the House. But it's too early to say whether this is an emerging trend, and there has been a swing back in recent times to more representation of members in the ministry. And when I think back to some of the high-profile senators during the 1990s, from across the political spectrum. I don't think this is particularly surprising. And I also wouldn't be surprised if this is actually the start of a longer-term trend, because I think it is smart politics for governments to have more key ministers in the chamber where they generally do not control the numbers to ensure the passage of the legislation. And of course, lower house ministers do that very competently now. But I think the informal contacts that that ministers in the Senate have with their colleagues can also be important in this task. And this is also something that I ask in my survey: how much informal contact do senators and members have with each other? Is it just with people in their own party? Do they know their Senate or House colleagues? Do they know people in the other House? Examination of executive legislative relations also opens debates on wider parliamentary reforms, which I won't go into here. But innovations like joint question times or ministers appearing before the other House are also things that are worth looking into and thinking about in terms of representation and accountability. And these are occurring at a state level right now. So I'd just like to conclude with some more general observations on the state of democratic representation in Australia, based on some of my previous research, and also raise some other possible, albeit controversial, reforms to improve representation. I note that at the last election, the average enrolment per lower house electorate is about 90,000 voters. So compared to other Westminster-derived parliamentary systems, this is quite a lot. So across the Tasman in New Zealand, the average for their electorate seats at the last election was only 42,000. And I'm not including the proportional representation list seats that they also have in their single chamber. In the UK, it's an average of 68,000 registered voters, but I've also included the total population per division in brackets, given that there isn't compulsory registration enrolment in all of these countries, whereas there is in Australia. Finally, the average for another more populous country, Canada, is at about 76,000 voters per MP or SMP. Now, while the argument to increase the number of politicians would predictably be unpopular, or at least a good media target, there is certainly a strong case for such reform, given that the last significant increase occurred 25 years ago. So perhaps rather than debates about politicians' pay, we should be thinking about whether we have the right number of representatives, given the workloads and demands we make and the expectations we have as an electorate. This is something that I also asked in my survey, along with whether more staffing or office entitlements, particularly for geographically larger electorates, would help improve representation. Increasing the number of parliamentarians could also improve the potential pool for ministerial talent, again, particularly as that pool is limited to the governing party. Larger backbenchers could also assist improving the accountability of the executive, again, particularly as much as this is done within the party rather than the parliament at large. But such reforms are unlikely to be undertaken in the foreseeable future. So in the interim and in conclusion, I'd say to members that you should be thankful that unlike the UK and Canada and in many other bicameral and unicameral countries, there are democratically elected representatives in the upper house to share the workload. Thank you.
Your slide that has primary votes.
Yeah.
I would argue that that's probably misleading, mm-hmm. in the sense that, I mean, Fielding got 50 however many out of several million, whereas Rudd got 43 out of what? An average of 96? Mm-hmm. And it's really the percentage that counts if you're talking about representation, I would argue. But my main question is to do with work patterns. Are you going to be asking politicians their views on potential changes to the pattern in which they work? I mean, to me, I can see a lot of benefit of changing to the fly-in, fly-out system that they use for iron ore workers, or offshore workers on oil rigs, where they come in, they do 12 or 15, 12-hour shifts, and then they fly out. It saves airfares, it saves a whole lot of things. And I guess my question is there any support to change, not necessarily to that model, but overall change in the patterns?
Okay, yeah. I'll just go back to your first point. Yeah. I mean, the slide on primary vote, I mean, it is a provocative slide. And obviously, it is the percentages that ultimately matter to get elected and to be a representative. But what I was just trying to do is just turn it on its head and say, well, yes, we've constructed the system like that. It doesn't have to be like that. It's not like that in other countries. And just to thinking about, well, what does it mean to be a representative? The other thing in thinking about that is just the idea of Prime Minister being head of government. Now, we don't directly elect Prime Minister. It's elected by the governing party. Yet when you ask people in opinion polls, etc., who's the preferred Prime Minister? Who do you like as leader? And I think there, I mean, we do have this sort of presidential style of election campaigns where a lot of people probably are just voting for their preferred Prime Minister or preferred leader. So what I was trying to do is just to break that down. Well, actually, our system is a little bit more complicated than that. I mean, it is a parliamentary system derived from Westminster, and so we don't have that directly elected head. Yet the Prime Minister has so much authority and power in that position, but he's only elected by, you know, what was it, 40,000, 40-something thousand people. Well, given authority and power, is the party in the Parliament, but it's not the people voting, though. I'm just trying to break down that those sorts of differences.
But the representatives are voting.
Yeah, the representatives. The Prime Minister indirectly elected in that stage. So just opening that up and challenging some of those conceptions on that side of things. But also just to turn on its head this idea that, you know, members are more representative as well, when senators could argue, well, we're representing more people and are elected by more people as well. So it's that on the work patterns in the survey. I'm actually just asking them what their current work patterns are, because that's something that we really don't know much about. There's lots of stereotypes, media commentary on what they think politicians do. And in terms of academic research, there's not a lot. There's some sort of broad topologies on this function and this function and this function. But I think the wider community does sort of lack, on the day-to-day level, what it is parliamentarians and the different types of things that they have to be able to do. So I'm hoping this is a starting point for other debates later on. But I think it's important to firstly start off with what are we working with now before thinking about what is the ideal situation. But again, members and senators often float ideas. I can remember Senator Joyce floating the idea of electronic voting, such that you don't even have to leave your electorate, things like that. So you're hopefully getting some data to open up those other discussions down the track. Yes.
I thought that was really interesting, Scott. Thanks for that. And I thought the myth busting was particularly interesting. I think there is a common perception that the Senate is the state's house, and I think there are senators right now who go into the chamber and talk about it in those terms. So that was interesting. I was particularly interested in the paradox you kind of drew between the sense of illegitimacy associated with the Senate, related, I think, probably to the lack of one vote, one value in the way that the electorates are drawn, and the paradox between that and the fact that they have elected people from a broader range of the society, so in some respects, you said be more representative. And I'm wondering if you've given thought to the kinds of any reforms that could be made to the way that the Senate is elected that would deal with that perception of its illegitimacy in terms of the way it's elected. You know, roughly the same population as the ACT, and yet we have two and there are 12 in Tasmania. But those kinds of perceptions and the way that other countries have reformed their voting systems in order to embrace a more representative model.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one The way I got interested in this topic was actually through a conference last year on bicameralism, which assembled people from all around the world looking at bicameral systems and thinking about what that means in practice. And many countries around the world actually look to Australia in thinking about reforms, and Britain, Canada in particular, that have unelected upper houses, on how they could actually improve their systems. So I think whilst there is a lot of criticism within Australia, it's sort of seen as a very good system, a very logical system. But going back to this, this one value, as I sort of briefly mentioned, we don't even have that in the lower house. So I think if people are really serious about one vote, one value, well, then we need to look at our lower house electorates. And part of the reason for that is the constitutional requirement. And Tasmania has 5 members, and I'm not suggesting that change, but going to that last slide, I think bringing down the number of people per electorate, that would naturally smooth out all electorates across the country and wouldn't require any state to lose electorates. So that would be that. As far as the Senate is concerned, I did look at this a few years ago and wrote a paper for the Democratic Audit, which is a research project for the ANU led by Professor Marion Saw. It's actually coming out in a book this month, where I raised the possibility, well, we could still have proportional representation, but on a national level. So the best proportional representation methods are the ones that elect more people, because you get more proportionate in that system, whereas typically it's 6 senators per state, so it's still not as proportional as it could be. Now, of course, there are constitutional restraints on doing that, and I think there would be lots of public opposition, particularly from smaller states, but one way to get around that would be requiring parties to order their candidates such that they have one from each state. So in every 6 positions, they ensure that they have at least one candidate from each state. So that way you'd still get the outcome that each state has equal number of senators, but you bring down the electoral thresholds because you're voting on a national basis, and you get more proportionality that way. So I think that something like that could be a way of modernising our Senate while still retaining the very sort of positive features that we have now, but getting more proportionality, still protecting smaller states, ensuring that they have representatives, but bringing down those thresholds.
The discussion, especially with our federalism, which I think is really getting, really does need some work, and we start talking about hospitals, states, Commonwealth funding, these things, and education, and grappling with dysfunctional local government, the issue of regional representation in Australia in the Senate and these state lines, and when you start talking to people across, especially across northern Australia, where the lines don't really indigenous peoples, mining companies, and these people are really, what are these state boundaries so that's another perspective, I guess. I don't know if you've touched on that at all, Scott.
Yeah, that's something I want to go into as well, because I think, again, looking at the mapping of the Senate offices, I mean, they're so concentrated in the capitals outside of Tasmania. Now, I think the justification is, from Senate, it's easier to travel from the capitals, so that's why they do it. But I was quite surprised to see the number of National Party senators that have based themselves in capitals. I wouldn't have thought that would have been the case. But I think we do need to start thinking about, I mean, if they are representatives of the whole state, rural and regional Australia really does miss out. And that's also something that was taken up by previous fellow Jennifer Curtin in looking at rural and regional Australia. But that could be another way, is actually thinking about maybe having regions elect senators rather than states. And that's actually permitted under the Constitution. That would just require legislative change to do that.
If I can just mention, because I was in Canada about a month ago, and they're very keen. I think their Prime Minister appointed 18 new senators to their upper house and said publicly, this is the last time I'm going to ever do this. So they were very interested in talking to us, and the President of the Senate was the leader of that delegation. So they were very keen to talk to us about our structures and whatever. So I think they're
they've certainly got a pretty big debate going on in Canada about non-representative upper house. I think their committees try hard to do good work, but I think it's that non-representative, and they're appointed till 75, and I think the public's a bit leery of that.
It may have been more of a reflection on how long Harper thinks he's going to be in the changes to the Senate.
Very true.
We have a moment for
thanks, Scott. Very interesting. Love the PowerPoint. Numbers can be misleading, and I was quite surprised by the figure that you came up with early in your presentation calculated senators spent 2% of their time on committee work.
That's the collective. Yeah, no, it's not.
How
it's not
did you get to that?
Yeah, it was just looking at the collective time, so calculating all senators. The figure I got was from the Department of the Senate reports on how many hours were spent and then divided that by the senators. But of course, not all some senators don't spend time on the committees, others spend a lot more time. So the survey data will actually produce a more accurate figure, which I've compiled at the end. But it was more just to, I think people have their particular perceptions of what senators and members do, and it was more to sort of show, well, senators actually do much more than just committee work. But no, it's not an accurate figure.
No, it certainly is a perception or myth-busting figure.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the situation of how we work now. That, you know, one works in a whole different, I know I do, you know, with a laptop in a whole, your office is not, you know, this. You don't have to be in an office or in your office. And this, I mean, the perception of the public isn't, you know, their representative is in his office or in the parliament. That perception gets me a bit sometimes that you know, people work on your mobile phones, your laptop, anywhere, and you do a day's work, and you're not in a physical location. I guess senators would probably argue that as well.
Yeah, I think so. I've only had a few interviews at this stage, but senators say comment more, they don't spend as much time in their electorate offices as members, because they're spending much more time travelling, and they don't feel the pressure to be there as well, where members do feel they have to be seen in the electorate constantly.
And probably have interviews. I mean, you know, you do interviews in your office at certain times, and I think there was an old political exercise of making sure you did all your interviews on one day, so there was a big pile of people around your electoral office. I mean, that was when I started, I think that's probably different, you know, this piece down, but it was a sort of a political tactic, I suppose, to, in your suburban office, if you had piles of people, you know, lined up outside or in your waiting room, it was look how many people are around Dick Adams' office.
Yeah.
Okay, but so I guess in a political world, it's always that we expect this kind of thing as well.
I guess also just linking that back with your earlier point about rural and regional representatives. I was talking to a former Labor member in a regional electorate who was saying that just to be able to do media in the electorate would require, because it's not all concentrated like in capital cities, would have to travel, you know, 1 hour north to do that region, 1 hour south to do that region, etc., etc. And also is expected to be across all of the issues much more than someone in urban Brisbane, where there are other representatives that talk about that, whereas you're expected to be seen to do that. And that's quite amazing when you think about a single day just to be able to do, you know, a 5 minute media interview, you're half your day gone.
Yeah, that's right, about the briefing, getting it together, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's more and more about the pitches, isn't it? I mean, Prime Minister's had a hard at on quite a lot in recent weeks and months. So yeah, you see that plays its role. So that's modern politics in media-driven, 24-hour system. So yeah, there's a lot of influences, I guess.
What are you hearing or expecting to hear about why people choose one chamber over the other? And my suspicion is that it's going to be, this was my first or best opportunity to get in. But, I mean, are people actually saying they want to be in a house of review, or I want to be in a, I've got an attachment to my local electorate, or...
Both. So I haven't, most of my interviews so far have actually been on the Labor side, and all of them have commented on just the factional system, and that plays a big part in where they go. But despite that, they did have preferences. Maybe not the preference they want that they finally got, but before they went in, they did have a preference, quite strong preferences, one or the other.
Based on?
Based on, I guess, what they thought they would do, but also, and this isn't from interviews with politicians themselves, but from observers, I think, and I'm not a psychologist, but maybe personality type might count for it as well. I'd love to be able to explore this, but I don't have the expertise in this area, but more extroverted people probably go for the lower house compared to the Senate, given the campaigning involved and just, you know, those day-to-day tasks that you're expected to do. So I think that could also be a factor that's playing in people's minds.
Can we talk out, Scott?
I think we might be.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
You've done a lot. Very good. Oh, no. It's just the number of hours on the